Welcome to the Dildorks, dorky discourse on sex, dating, and masturbating. My name is Kate Sloan. I'm a sex journalist, a sex blogger, and definitely when I'm hanging out with someone who I intend to maybe fuck, if there's any situation in which they have to slap something, like a cocktail shaker while they're making a drink, or I actually can't think of another example right now of casual slapping, but it definitely does happen. I'm all over that shit. I am watching. I am paying attention. It is important information. Who are you, friend?
I'm Bex. I am a sex educator and a sex nerd and too busy thinking about other casual reasons people might slap something to come up with one of my own here.
I guess maybe if you were visiting a farm, I could see someone casually, like, slapping the side of a horse or a cow pridefully or something. Yeah, I'm really having trouble.
When that meme was big, where it was like, you could fit a lot of blank in this. People were slapping everything.
Yeah. There is casual slapping that happens, and I do notice it. And the reason I bring this up is because our episode today is about vetting potential partners. Yes. Which is a word that I actually don't hear that much of outside of kink space. So I'll just define it briefly. We're using it here in the sense of, like, figuring out whether a potential partner is someone you want to do stuff with or is safe or is, you know, just someone you want to have some kind of experience with. And that is a process. And I think it's worth doing an episode about for sure.
Yeah, and that was actually my first question was, I wanted to dig a little into what exactly we're determining when we talk about vetting, because it is a term I hear thrown around a lot in the kink community. And I think it can sometimes be interpreted as, like, judging someone's safety, or, like, as if that you can get a universal report card and be like, ah, this person has been vetted, and they can be played with. and my experience of it is a lot more individual, whereas it is more like, yes, it is a process of determining if I feel safe with this person, and everyone's risk profile is a little different, but it's also just, do I want to play with this person? It's the steps between, oh, hey, they're hot, and like, we should do some shit.
Yeah, I agree. I think also that the dichotomy between, like, safe and not safe is not as much of a light switch as we sometimes think of it as being. There are people who could be doing things that are unsafe within your particular boundaries, but maybe are something that they're comfortable with, which is, like, part of the whole risk-aware consensual kink thing. Like, I've met people who are not into playing while intoxicated, which is perfectly reasonable, but I am into that. So part of our vetting would be both of us figuring out, not only is this a person who is safe to do that with, or safe to do what we want to do with, but also, like, do we connect? Are we in it for the same reasons, more or less? Or even if not, like, is there some small space of overlap where we can find something to do together? And do we seem to be on the same page about what we want to do together?
Mm-hmm. And I think it can also, I don't know, it feels like it is often talked about as, I don't want to say combative, but this kind of oppositional process, like a test that the other person has to pass.
Yeah.
To be granted access to your junk, or whatever it is this is going to entail. And, like, I mean, yeah, there are some hoops it's reasonable to expect someone to jump through, but to some degree, I think it's more about compatibility, right? And more about, is there a mutual excitement here? Is there something that we're not just, oh, I guess that is both within our risk profiles, and sure, we could both do that. Yeah, sure. Like, it's not about reaching compromise in, I think, the, like, general understanding about it. It's more about, like, finding mutual enthusiasm and excitement about a thing that you both also just feel good and comfy about.
Yeah, I think for me, there's also an element to vetting that is, like, figuring out how much of our language and, like, sort of more theoretical understanding of kink is similar, because, of course, there are people who do not play in the same scenes that I play in, like, maybe people who have only done kink stuff in private with one or two partners before or whatever. So they may not have all the same vocabulary that I have. things like subspace, safe words. I mean, they may have like heard of these things, but they might not have experience directly with them. So it's helpful for me in the vetting conversation to get a sense of like not only what they're into, but kind of like their skill level and their experience level, because I'm not necessarily going to like say no to someone because of their experience level, depending on what it is that we're trying to do. But I do want to have a sense of like how I need to communicate to them about this and how much I need to explain to them.
Right. And like my vetting conversation might wind up with me at a point where I'm like, wow, so we're not doing that thing I thought we were doing. We're going to take several steps back and you're going to hit me, but you're not going to light me on fire. You know what I mean? Although I think we'll get into later. I do have some concerns if someone is vastly overestimating their own skill level of being like, well, we can do this other thing where I guess it's okay if you're bad at it. Like, I want my partners to be an accurate or at least semi-accurate judge of their own skill.
Yeah, hopefully.
So we're talking a little bit about these kind of gray areas and how vetting isn't quite the light switch that it sometimes gets talked about. I'm curious if you notice any situations in your life where you maybe vet people more strongly or intensely versus other situations where you either intentionally or unintentionally notice a little more lax?
Yeah, definitely. I think it depends a lot on like what I'm intending on doing. Like I've definitely had like mm-hmm. Tinder dates where I intended that like, or I assumed rather that they would be fairly vanilla sex if they ended in sex. And so I'm definitely not vetting at the same level. Even in that situation, I can still look for, does this person respect consent and boundaries? Does this person seem interested in my ideas and my pleasure? But I'm not going to be as intense about like, where did you learn how to do the things that we're going to do? Because they probably didn't go to a class in the back room of a sex shop to learn a lot of those skills. Although you never know, mm-hmm. I guess. I also think if I'm at a kink event that is for some kind of highly specialized kink, I'm going mm-hmm. to be more likely to assume that the people I'll talk to at that space will like share some vocabulary with me and will have a certain skill level. That's not always a fair assumption. Like I think definitely some people go to these specialized like fetish specific events having not tried these things before and like they're just curious about it. But you can kind of read like from how comfy someone is, you know, at the hypnokink event or whatever it may be, like how many times they've been there or how much they've done this thing or how confident they are in the skills that they are maybe purporting to have. So in those situations, I might not vet quite as strongly, especially if it seems like someone who I already know and trust already knows and trusts this person.
Yeah, that's a big one for me. Anyone that is like friends of a friend or that I meet through like the slut referral network, I'm usually a little more comfy being like, well, this person who I have vetted trusts them, or is willing to vouch for them for me.
Right.
So that will generally mean a lot, to me. I think it's really interesting the way you talked about kink spaces versus like Tinder dates and stuff, because when I meet people in kink spaces, I do like, I am a little more lax on my vetting, also just because I know I have people backing me up there. Mm-hmm. I know that I am surrounded, like most of the events I go to, I have community members there. Other people that know me, it's more likely that this person I'm talking to is a friend of a friend, and shit can only go so wrong in a very public play party. Like, I might have a real bad time, like, someone might do something real dickish, but they're probably not gonna murder me. Yeah. So, I've got that going for me. Whereas I personally find I'm a lot more nervous around like Tinder dates and online dating, and go through a lot more vetting before I even go on a date. Mm-hmm. Although I think a lot of that may also be my own anxiety of like, oh God, I'm gonna have to spend several hours alone with this human being. I must make sure I adore them first.
Yeah, I feel that. And I think also, like, to the extent that I do vet people who I assume are vanilla, it a lot of it happens just in conversation and from observing their behavior in conversation. Like, for example, mm-hmm. are they a person who's constantly interrupting me and talking over me? Like, in my experience, that could mean they don't really care about me that much. They don't really care about my boundaries. They're not that interested in my input, which is going to be super important if we want to have sex that's going to satisfy us both. I could also pay attention to consent-related cues. So, like, one that came up a lot for me when I would be going on Tinder dates is if I expressed hesitance about having another drink, sometimes someone would be like, oh, come on, like, have another one, which is a tough one to translate because sometimes it actually just means I like talking to you and I want to continue talking to you. But if they're actually, like, trying to get me drunk, like, I just, it's, that's a red flag for me. So this is, like, pretty subtle stuff that can come up in, like, just about any conversation with a potential partner, regardless of, like, kinkiness level or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm. There, I've definitely heard a lot of people talk about, just say no to something. Literally, like, pick something and see how it goes.
That's a great piece of advice, I think, because, like, you're definitely going to find something out. And even if you, like, pre-prepare a thing that you want to say no to, I think that that could be a really interesting litmus test to do on your dates.
Yeah, and one last thing I want to add to that that I've noticed is that I sometimes vet people less if I read them as queer.
Yeah,
or particularly as trans, if I read them as one of my people. Mm-hmm. And that is less a conscious decision and more a something I've noticed I do in myself, which, like, to some extent tends to track fairly well. People in the queer community tend to have thought about a lot of the same things I have to, engaged with a lot of the same ideas, and tend to be fairly on the same page. But at the same time, that is zero data points. That is not a friend of a friend. That is not they have gained admission to this event that I am also at and are approved by the like event runners. That is this fucker has a cool haircut, which, like, while endearing, not necessarily the best reason to trust them. So it is a thing that I'm working on.
It is true, but I think that points to how we'll tend to automatically look for qualities in people that work with, like, who we are and, like, what kind of sex we're looking for. So, like, it does make sense that you would be more drawn to other trans folks because on some level you know that, like, they're going to be probably chiller about you being trans and, like, all that that entails in a sexual scenario. Whereas, like, for me, I guess an equivalent you could say is, like, I will pay attention to how a person talks about women, how they talk about women in their lives. So, like, sisters, female friends, female bosses, just, like, even female celebrities, like, I'll pay attention to how they talk about them because even if they're being very complimentary to me, like, they could very well be one of those, like, you're not like the other girls, people who, like, actually on a pretty base level, like, doesn't like women, despite being nice to me in that moment. And so that can be a really interesting window for me.
Yeah, definitely. And this is tangential, but you mentioned celebrities, and it did also remind me that it can be very easy to be more lax on your vetting of folks who are well known in your community, who
have some sort of
social prestige.
This is such a real thing.
Which, like, yes, they have the social capital of many people supporting them, which, you know, you think is in line with the friend of a friend thing. However, have you spoken to many of those people? And how many of those people actually have close, intimate relationships with this person? Or have they just built up a lot of social capital? Because that, like, sometimes, yeah, someone is well known in the community because they're a great person to play with and lots of people like them. And if you sit down with, like, lots of people who are close to them, they would go, yeah, oh my God, they're great. And other times you sit down with the people in their community and they're like, yeah, somehow they just got momentum. Like, we thought they were chill for a minute, or somehow they got momentum outside of this community and shit's just happening now. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of that is, like, abusers are very good at manipulation and being charming in many cases because they kind of have to be in order to continue doing what they're doing, especially if they're like preying on people over a large community. And I've seen this a lot, and this is why, like, the friend of a friend thing is really great, but as you pointed out, it is not everything. And just because someone wasn't abusive with one other person doesn't mean they won't be abusive with you, unfortunately. I do think it's, like, a really great tool to be able to talk to people in your community, like, what do you think about this person? And it can usually give you a hint. I particularly like to look at, is this person in a long-term partnership with a woman, and does the woman seem happy in that relationship? But it's definitely not everything, and people can turn out to be awful, unfortunately.
And I mean, I think that speaks to, we're about to get into kind of more nitty-gritty of what exactly we look for. I mean, we've touched on it a little bit when we're vetting someone, but I think that is, that just goes to say that this is not like a perfect test or system. It, I mean, at its core, vetting is about establishing trust with someone, which is a very individual process. And the thing with trust is it can be broken. But I wanted to have this conversation, and but I wanted to have a conversation about some of the tools we use to kind of give us those little boosts of trust and put them in people's tool belts so that they can gather kind of clusters of information, right? These are things we learn and build up over time. You may take two or three of these things and kind of look at the cluster of symbols to decide that you're comfortable with someone, at least, you know, doing whatever it is you're doing. So I'm curious, what are some of the direct questions that you like to ask people when you're going through the vetting process with them to kind of get a feel for if you think they're a good match?
Yeah, that's interesting that you say direct questions, because I think most of my vetting happens in more indirect ways, like I was saying. And I think that that's partly like an anxiety thing on my part of like, there is something kind of vulnerable and scary about being like, I don't entirely know for sure that you're a safe person, so I'm going to ask you some questions with the explicit intent of figuring that out. But at the same time, that is in itself a litmus test, because any reasonable consent conscious, probably on the safer side, risk-aware consensual kink type of person is going to completely understand why you would want to ask those types of questions, and may even have some of those questions for you. I think if someone gets offended about that, that's definitely a red flag. Even though, like, I understand why it could be a little bit, like, hurtful if you think you've developed rapport with someone and they're like, well, I don't know for sure if you're not going to attack me. But, you know, that's just one of those situations where if you do have kind of a prideful or hurt feeling about it, like, that's not important. That's not something you need to, like, bring up right now. You should just answer the questions. So, I mean, one thing I really like to do is ask about, like, if there's a particular thing we're going to be doing, I'll be like, can you tell me some of your past experiences with that thing? If we're doing, like, a heavy spanking, I definitely want to know, have you done a heavy spanking before? And, like, what was that like? I like to hear about negotiation in past scenes and aftercare in past scenes. I particularly like to ask about, like, have you or a partner ever, like, safe worded and, like, what happened there? How did you deal with that? Because even if their answer is no, like, I've never had a partner safe word with me, the way that they talk about that may even give you some information about, like, how they would react to that or how they would feel about that.
Because if they're saying it as if it's, like, an obvious thing, like, no, I've never had anyone safe word for me. Like, what do you think? I am bad at this? Like, that's a very different energy. And that is certainly an energy I think a lot of baby doms carry.
Yeah, or even worse, like, no, I don't need to have a safe word. I don't use those. Because it's one thing if you say, like, I've never needed to have one before, right? Because, like, for some people, you only really use safe words in, like, consensual non-consent scenarios. And if you're in a different type of scenario and you want to stop, you just say, I want to stop. So that's reasonable to me. But what's important to me is how does the person respond to that question anyway? Because if they're acting like safe words are ridiculous and unnecessary, that's a different thing from just being like, yeah, you're right. Like, I haven't actually done that before, but like, here's how I would behave if I was doing that. And let's talk about it more.
Yeah. Or if they're like, yeah, all the time, as if it's like a badge of honor of how happy they play. Like, I'm okay with someone who spends most of their scenes on the edge of what their bottom can take. When I'm bottoming, that's usually why I'm there, to get to 8 or 9. Like, more or less. However, I don't want my top talking about it that way. I want them being like, yeah, you know, I want them describing it the way I just did. Yeah, you know, it's a fact of life in the way that I play. You know, we spend a lot of time around there, so it's come up a couple times. Let me tell you about it, you know? Like, yeah, of course, I'm tough. See these guns?
I also think it's interesting to notice how the person talks about their past partners, in terms of, like, are they sharing a lot of personal details with you? Or are they saying a lot of hurtful, mean things about the person? Like, because my sense is, like, if someone's going to be shitty about their past partners, they very well could be shitty about you one day. And I want someone who has, you know, discretion and good sense socially. So that would give me pause for sure.
One of the direct questions I come to a lot is, well, in general, when I'm asking direct questions, I try to keep them really broad and open-ended. Because, like you're saying, I'm less interested in their answer and more interested in
how they're
answering it. Right. So if I'm asking, you know, I'll ask a lot, you know, oh, tell me about your kit, or tell me about what safety stuff, you know, tell me about what safety measures you put in place when you play with this. Or, you know, I will just talk to them about the other scenes they've had, have them tell me a story, even if it's not about safe wording, just tell me about your other scenes, because I'm curious about the details they share. I'm curious about what's important to them about that scene, because for me, something that I know I'm looking for on a compatibility level is, I tend to play really well with people who are interested in getting into, like, the weird psychological shit, and who will spend time telling me about the, like, weird elaborate story they came up with for their role play. Or, you know, the clever predicament bondage they devised for someone, and the trap they created, or the time they were being really, really silly. And those are all clues that we play similarly. Whereas for me, anyone who, when we're having a conversation and they jump straight into dirty talk or seem bored by the, like, nitty-gritty kind of negotiating, because anyone who's bored with negotiating full stop or having a conversation about sex and kink that isn't sexy or kinky is a red flag for me, where I'm like, the things I want to do are not going to be safe to do with you. Just full stop. Yeah. We're just not there. But someone who doesn't want to talk about the really nerdy shit, like, the stuff that I'll get into, but, like, okay, like, I want to do rope bondage in this kind of tie, but then I'll be like, okay, but why? And what feelings do I want to feel while I'm doing it? And who am I going to pretend you are? And what's our backstory? How long has this been building, really? Someone who doesn't want to go to that, like, third level, like, we might be down, like, I might be down to play, you know, in, like, a public or a group scene with them. But I'll get a feel for, oh, you know, like, you're safe, you'd have a great scene with some other people, but, like, I don't know that this is going to be my jam.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And like, to your point about people who can't have a conversation about sex or kink without getting sexy or kinky, as a submissive woman, I've had a lot of experiences with people like trying to dom me in conversation. And it's such a like fine line, because like, to some extent, because I am submissively oriented, like dominant flirting does appeal to me and does work for me, and also communicates, you know, that maybe we're compatible in that way. But there is a difference between dominant flirting and like outright doming someone. Like, you should not be calling me any honorifics on a first date unless I've told you that I'm okay with specifically you calling me that. And you certainly should not be giving me any orders or instructions unless I have indicated I'm open to that. It's very weird. I remember I was like talking on OkCupid once to some guy who found out I was submissive and immediately was like, go take your panties off for me, because I was at work. And I was like,
no,
like, I barely know anything about you, and same, you know, vice versa. And like, that's not appropriate. We haven't talked about that. I feel like these are so often either shitty, unethical kinksters or like vanilla people who are trying to talk a big game and seem kinkier than they are to impress me. And it's like, you don't have to do that. And it's actually often weird when you try to do that.
and like, we can tell is the thing. I will say, just a side note, my favorite tool for like dummy flirting when either I'm not in charge yet or I'm not sure if I'm allowed to be in charge of this thing is to just like make it a question, like, wow, what if you did what I said right now, and when it did that, because that just gives them the opportunity to like take that and run with it, or just like, you know, yeah, what if, and move on, you know, like, rather than, I think, that thing that I think a lot of baby doms or vanillas trying to talk a big game pull, which is like, if I say it loud enough, it becomes a command. With enough authority, if I just put enough bass in my voice, it just gives me the authority.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I definitely like the question approach. And I also like the approach of talking about it more theoretically. Like, you know, if I'm on our date and I'm getting up to go get a drink, a dom might say, like, oh, I really love in DS dynamics sometimes when a sub will, like, ask me what they should order at the bar and I get to tell them. And, like, that, you know, depending on how you inflect that when you say it, could just seem like you're actually just like sharing a fun anecdote and just like saying a kinky thing that like you thought about. And if I'm into that, that gives me a very big opportunity to be like, oh, I would like that, or to talk about it more. And so I think, yeah, that's a really like good low pressure way of doing that.
Yeah, I love that. Or even just, you know, looking at something and being like, you know, oh, I've always wanted to play with a submissive who wants to do these kinds of things. Or, you know, oh, I'd love to, like, buy that gorgeous outfit for a submissive and, like, you know, see them in it or whatever. Mm-hmm. Where you can just, like, I mean, it's a flirty date. The implication is the submissive in front of you is this theoretical submissive, but you give them a moment to, like, hop into the role willingly rather than just be like, wow, yeah, a sub would look really hot in that. Oh, my God. Which is also a really totally fine way to just sidestep that real carefully. One of the things you were bringing up earlier, though, is that we do a lot of this, and I do as well. I have a lot of this conversation, not really blatantly, right? I'm not sitting down and being like, so you might kill me. So I have some questions to make sure you don't. And then some follow-up questions to make sure this is fun and you know how to use the flogger I'm about to hand you. So it's fine if we just step through these. Because obviously that can feel really awkward and, like, disjointed. And I'm curious if, other than just kind of bringing this stuff up in conversation, if you have any other tools to make finding this out a little less weird and clinical. Like, it shouldn't be an interview process in the middle of your date.
That's interesting you use the word interview, because actually one of my favorite strategies is to kind of pull a Bex and make it into a joke or frame it and be like, you know, oh, I'm so interested in like you as a dominant. Do you mind if I like go into journalist mode for a second? Which like I usually use that line because I am a journalist. But there's other ways you can say basically the same thing. Like, do you mind if I like interview you a little bit? Like as if this is like a fun job interview, you know, kind of like make fun of the fact that you're doing it. Cause I think that sets you both at ease. Cause like it's an important thing, but at the same time, like it can work better if you downplay it a little bit to make it seem less important. Cause you it's the same with a job interview. Like someone's just not going to perform as well if they're stressed out and feeling very high pressure about it. Mm-hmm. So like any kind of joke that downplays it. I also think it's important to get across somehow that this is not necessarily a pass-fail situation. Like, you know, if you talk about spanking and rope bondage and knife play, maybe they don't really, like, quote-unquote, pass the knife play part of the interview. Like, you just don't feel like they have the skill level or the, you know, reasons for being into it that you're into. But maybe you're going to be into the other two things. So if you can make it seem more like a fun, open-ended conversation rather than like there is a right answer that I am looking for, I think that will be better.
And I like what you talked about making the joke, but also kind of creating the container for like, this is a space where conversation is going to feel a little different than it normally would. Like it might feel stunted and weird. I love the journalism thing you said. I also think this is a great opportunity for just the question game, which kind of gets into one of the tools I use, is that I role model all of the things I want to hear. Not necessarily the answers, but I start by giving as much information as I'm going to ask for. So I can set it up as the question game and be like, hey, you want to take turns asking like really nerdy questions about our kink stuff and see what overlaps, you know, find out filthy things about each other, whatever. And that way, it isn't fully one-sided. The spotlight isn't on them. Because, like, I recognize I'm comfortable in the way I kink and the things that I do and what I know for safety. This person might not be. Just like you talked about earlier, like, I play with intoxicants. This person may not be down for that. I play with weight, really heavy impact. This person might be like, hey, I'm a top, but like, I don't know about hitting you with chains. Like, I don't know about punching your ass. Like, I don't know. They might be like, I have this little flogger that says slut on it, and it's very cute. Or this little paddle, you know, and it was $12.99 at Spencer's, and this is what I thought we were signing up for. Like, I can also fail in as many ways as there is fail, you know? So I do like to set it up very much that, like, you may also not want to play with me. Like, there is just as much, I have just as much to ask here, especially because at a lot of times at events, I am one of the DMs or one of the teachers. So I'm already in a place where I might, I don't know, read as more celebrity status to someone who is newer, which just sounds like the most conceited thing to say, but
no, I see what you're saying. I think you're trying to sort of lower your own status and level the playing field, which I think is something that you have to like read the room to know like when you need to do that. This conversation is also making me think about, you know how like when you work at a store, sometimes you have to tell a customer something difficult that they're not going to want to hear, and you hide behind like it's just store policy, it's just company policy. So in the same way, something I've done occasionally as well, if I'm like flirting with someone who I maybe want to play with, is say like, I am interested in like maybe playing with you, but like before I do that, I really have to ask you like, you know, the questions I always ask. It's just a formality, you know, it's just like part of my process, just something I do. Because I think that that like automatically like sets them up with the like, you know, happy knowledge that you're interested in them. And the reason you're asking these questions is that you're interested in them. So it's a more positive, potentially more relaxing note to start this conversation off on. And it also communicates to them that like you take this stuff seriously enough that you're going to do it And, you know, I think that that is just like a more comfortable way of getting that across.
Mm-hmm. I've definitely also chalked it up to like ADHD stuff where I'm like, listen, I have a silly acronym. We're going to go through the whole thing because if I don't do these questions in order, I won't ask one of them. And probably one of them's important. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do it in this like weirdly formal way, because if I don't go through my routine, it's gone. You're hot. I'll forget everything. You're very distracting. I can't help it. I'm sorry. and just, yeah, having that, not necessarily a third party, but that kind of other scapegoat of like, listen, we're going to do it this way because it's just the way I do it. You know, management says so in the back of my brain.
Yeah. And I think if you set it up like it's a quiz or a questionnaire or something, like as much as that can be awkward, it can also be really fun. And mm-hmm. I love that you have your own system, which we've talked about before, like the Simmer negotiation mm-hmm. checklist, because like if you have your own checklist or if you happen to mention in conversation, like I listen to this podcast where they talk about this negotiation checklist, like there's always a chance that the person will be like, ooh, that sounds fun. Let's do it. And then it becomes a game, except secretly it's a negotiation conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things we've very explicitly said quite a few many times is that this is a process of finding out if you want to play with someone. And this is something that happens generally over a long conversation. And often you start it when you're already invested in this person. But the thing is, sometimes the answer is you don't want to play with this person. Mm-hmm. And you've been talking to this person for a couple hours and you've just, you know, said, I'm really excited about playing with you. And I just have this one little formal quiz I have to go through. And you get to the end of the quiz and you're like, how does that conversation go? What do you do then?
Yeah, I think one of the considerations here is whether or not you tell them why the answer turned out to be no. And mm-hmm. I think in situations where like they're genuinely seeming to be unsafe or unethical in some way with the way that they approach stuff, I do think it's good to tell them that. Mm-hmm. This is kind of how I feel about breakups too, is like you don't necessarily need to tell someone why you're breaking up with them, but if it's something that like could potentially save someone later on who they're going to play with, like maybe you do want to tell them so that they can know about it and work on it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could straight up say to someone like, I don't think I'm really feeling great about like doing fire play with you because it doesn't sound like you totally have a handle on your safety protocols. But like if you ever get that figured out, like for sure, like let's talk again or whatever. Mm-hmm. I also think, just to wrap up that thought, if there is a specific reason, but it's like not really something that they can change or like not really something that's their fault, like maybe just an attraction thing. I don't always feel it's like super necessary to say that. I usually just say something sort of vague, like, I don't know that I'm really feeling it or I'm not vibing with it, whatever. Mm-hmm. I also think if at all possible, I usually like to offer some kind of alternative, even if it's just like, but I'd love to like get another drink with you and keep talking for a bit. Because it just ends it on a more positive note. And sometimes with me, this has been like, I don't actually feel like I'm in a good place for you to spank me tonight, but do you want to like make out for a bit? Or, you know, some kind of compromise isn't really the right word. And like consolation prize doesn't sound too great either, but like something that makes them feel less shitty about the sort of rejection. And certainly you're not obligated to do this. It's easy to like feel coerced into doing this kind of thing. And that's not what I'm saying. Like maybe you genuinely do want to make out with them, you just don't want them to hit you. And like I think that that's nice to talk about and to do if it's something you're both into.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's also great about that is it doesn't make the rejection the last interaction you've had with this person.
Yeah,
at least for the time being, because even if you're like, nope, bye, and they see you at the next party, like I would feel weird being like, hey, friend. And like, you might still be down with them being like your buddy, mm-hmm. but kind of prolonging the interaction after that moment of rejection to just like reaffirm that like, nah, like we're chill. I like you, provided mm-hmm. that those things are true.
Yeah.
To just have that be the most recent thing in their memory can be a really kind thing to do. because I know for me it's something that I would find really reassuring. And I do also tend to do that kind of, well, I may not be down for this thing, but I am down for these other things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually a little of two minds of what you said on what you said earlier about letting them know why, if it is like a safety thing. Because generally, like, I do want to be like, hey, you know, I'm feeling uncomfortable about this, or like, I'm an educator. I want to give people tools to improve. I don't want to teach people to lie better, which is also something I was a little worried about with parts of this episode. Like, I don't want to just give people a list of red flags so that they can avoid them. Those red flags are great. They show me the things I can't see. Mm-hmm. And I don't need you to just throw away the red flag and keep all of the concerning behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll often say something like you recommended, where I'm like, I don't feel like our safety protocols line up. Like, I feel like, I don't want to be like, I feel like I play safer than you. Because, like, honestly, you might be the one who has, like, maybe more higher safety standards than are, like, strictly necessary. Like, that's that. It feels like a weird value judgment. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, everyone and, is. And also, depending on the kink, as we were kind of alluding to earlier, like, there may not be just more safe or less safe. There may be different ways of being safe, depending on what your priorities are. Like, I know, like, if you have a certain illness that causes, like, easier bruising and you don't want to bruise, like, that may be your top consideration, as opposed to someone who really wants to make sure that, like, their knees are in a comfortable position for the duration of a spanking or something like that. Like, there's just, like, different ways of being safe. And if, like, you don't mesh for whatever reason, that's a totally valid thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I tend to set it more – I tend to – prefer to phrase things based on, like, these are where my boundaries are at, and, like, they just don't seem to line up. And I do even tend to do that if, like, I have been doing this a minute. I am kind of a professional in my field. Sometimes people say shit, and I go, that is not safe. Sorry. Just full stop. There is a lot of nuance in the world. That one, just don't love it. But even in those times, like, this person didn't come to me to educate them.
Yeah.
They didn't. So again, I'll say, like, I have some concerns about this. I don't feel the safest about this. That's about me. Like, if they really want to interrogate that and I feel like doing the work in that moment, I will.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it can be very great. I think it can be best to just be like, hey, like, I'm not feeling this. I don't think I'm down for this. I know I personally have a hard time with saying things like, oh, I'm not feeling that tonight, or I'm not feeling that in this moment, and then that person just shows up again. So that is the thing I am working on practicing, but it is so much scarier to just be like, no, just forever, no.
Yeah, I had that problem recently with someone who kept asking me out, who I did not want to go out with. And I had initially been like, oh, I don't think it's a good time. And then eventually my partner was like, why don't you just say, like, no, I'm not feeling it. No qualifiers, no added clauses. And I did that and it was effective. But I also want to add that, like, if you do feel like you need to lie or make up an excuse in order to get out of an encounter that seems unsafe or potentially unsafe, I support you in making that decision. I've done that many times. I've been like, you know what, I'm actually really tired, or you know what, I actually just, like, went through a really bad heartbreak or something. Like, usually I would, like, use some kernel of truth and blow it out into something bigger that seemed like a more legitimate excuse. And, like, We live in a world where sometimes it is kind of necessary to twist the truth a little bit in order to stay safe, especially depending on, like, power dynamics, gender dynamics, different considerations that may come up. And, like, I am not going to really fault anyone for doing that unless, like, their lie is actually causing harm in some way.
Yeah, for sure. We have these conversations about communication a lot where, like, no is a full sentence, and a lot of what we're talking about here is for those relationships that are in the gray area that people don't talk about as much, where you're like, oh, this person's chill, but like, I don't want to do these things. Or like, I'm going to see this person at parties again. And I do actually want to maintain, you know, a dynamic with them that is comfortable for both of us. Like, that is a practicality of the world that I think a lot of people in these conversations don't take into account, when they're like, no is a complete sentence and you can just say that and walk away, and you can, and you are entitled to, and we live in a society is the thing. And like, people are also going to hear that in ways, right? I think we can acknowledge that, like, there are varying degrees of how we interact with people, and there are a lot of tools that we sometimes use just to maintain social norms and niceties, and that's okay. Like, we're queer, poly, kinky pervs. We buck a lot of norms and niceties, but it's okay to also just fall in line with some of them. They're there for a reason.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think also the no is a complete sentence piece of wisdom does not work so well in the face of people who are going to try to argue with you about your no. Like, you can just keep saying no, or you can walk away, usually. But sometimes these people can be very persistent and insistent in a way that, like, just makes you feel like you need to say something else. That's usually a situation where I make up an excuse, or I say something that's like the truth, but like isn't really an excuse, but can be taken as such. Like, I used to just be like, no thanks, I have a boyfriend, which like sometimes like would be true, but I'm just leaving out the fact that I was non-monogamous, and people usually just are like, oh, okay, never mind.
No thanks, I have several boyfriends. What? Nothing.
I really don't have room for any more.
My dance card full. I'm polysaturated.
Yep. Let's do some listener questions. Speaking of attachment styles, which we were talking about last week, this person is wondering, how can I figure out whether someone's attachment style is compatible with mine in the early stages of dating so we don't waste each other's time? And this is actually deceptively tricky to do, because the way people behave when they're like on their best behavior at the beginning of a flirtationship is so different from how they might, you know, behave in their day to day in a long-term thing. And I think, like, you could, I guess, theoretically bring up the idea of attachment theory, and either they've heard of it, in which case you can talk about what they think their style is, or they haven't, in which case you can talk about it very theoretically and be very forthcoming, like, I'm pretty sure I'm anxious because XYZ, just, like, looking at these descriptions, like, which do you think you are, out of curiosity?
Yeah, I love the just like, wow, I was reading this cool book and I learned this neat thing. Isn't this fascinating? Let's talk about it for several hours. Like, that's my favorite trick in the book.
Yeah.
I do also think that if this is someone, you know, based on the question, it sounds like we're vetting them for a long-term relationship, right? I don't need to know their attachment style to get fucked tonight, probably.
Probably. Depends on how you play, I guess.
I guess. But I would look for clues in the ways they talk about their exes and the ways they talk about their other relationships and their family and things like that.
Yeah.
Look for, you know, if you ever have, you know, you're playing the question game kind of thing, conversations about what they find annoying in relationships. Mm-hmm. What pushes their buttons? Because that's the thing people are usually happy to tell you.
That's just a great question. I love that.
And if they're going into how people are clingy all the time and they feel like they need so much from them, and you're just like, a little avoidant babe, hey, look at you. No one ever has enough time for them. You have some anxiety clues, right? People don't tell me anything. They're always running away. Oh, really? Wow! You don't say. And obviously, this isn't foolproof, right? But I think that's the ways that people will accidentally tell you more than they think they're telling you.
Yeah, This person asked, are there any body language cues that could be a potential red flag? I know that, like, having gone on multiple dates with feminist-identified men, often they will, if they do touch me at all, like on a first date, they will either ask beforehand if it's okay, or they'll do it and then say, is this okay? I appreciate both of those. I think if someone is touching you in like a really overt or extended, like prolonged way without checking, that's usually not great. I mean, obviously nonverbal consent is a thing and does exist. But if you're uncomfortable with a certain type of touch and that person isn't noticing that or doesn't seem to care about that, that would for me be like a very bad red flag, and I would definitely want to ask them about that.
Yeah, for sure. There isn't a ton in terms of body language. I would say, like, eye contact, which is a complicated thing with neurodiversity and such, but if their eyes are all over the place and I don't have any other cues that they're attentive to the conversation we're having, that may not be a great sign. But I think what you were talking about is much more what I look for, whereas it's their body language in response to mine or their receptivity and understanding of my body language. So if I'm getting stiff or if I'm stepping back or if I like kind of pull away from them for a second and they just don't even register it, that's a problem for me. Whereas I think I see the other side of that a little bit more and notice that as like a particularly good sign if, I don't know, I'm having a conversation with someone and I look at something on my phone and my face changes and think, oh, what happened?
Yes. Right?
If I look off into the distance at someone and I very clearly see something and they're like in the middle of monologuing and go, oh, what's over there? And look over their shoulder to like see what I'm looking at. Or if I lean into them and they lean back and they start mirroring my touch, right? If our bodies move well together and if they are attentive to the things that I'm not just saying, but doing and expressing in other ways, that is a very good sign for me. And it's usually a sign that we will play well together.
Yeah. And I think it was you who has said before that, like, sometimes you don't fully know like how much you like someone until there's touching that happens on a date, or like you don't fully know like if someone's flirting with you until there's touching. And I agree. I feel very similarly. Like I think certain types of casual touch on an early date, like touching your arm to make a point or whatever, are great, obviously depending on the person, but like I'm into them. But I am gonna look for signs of, you know, them reading the room to do that, or them checking in to see if that was all right, or are they starting small and escalating only as I seem receptive to escalation. Yeah, and like you said, like these are all things that are very much complicated by neurodiversity, because reading social cues is like not a skill everybody has, and that's okay. Having dated at least one person on the autism spectrum, I think like I've noticed that folks who do struggle with like social cues often will like communicate that if that's something that they're trying to be like conscious of, and will be like extra conscientious about it. Rather than like kind of using it as an excuse to let them get away with things that are not really okay.
And that's definitely something, I mean, we all know I over communicate about everything. I'm like, I have had a thought, let me explain it to you in detail, and tell you my reasoning for it just to make sure we're on the same page. But I find that something I notice as a red flag is if I don't feel comfortable doing that around people, if I'm noticing myself like censoring myself in a weird way, or if I notice them like cutting me off on things where I'm like, yeah, that was a little frivolous, but like, aren't you curious about me? Like, yeah. I shared it because I thought it was interesting. Like, don't you... So that's something that I will also look for in myself, because I don't tend to notice other people first. I notice myself like not saying things and censoring myself. And I'm like, huh, where'd that impulse come from? That's not like me.
Yep. All right. This person asks, how do you address potential red flags that come up on a second or third date? And I love this question because it is this kind of in-between space where, like, if I like them enough to have gone on a second or third date, I'm probably invested enough that I don't necessarily want to, like, throw the whole person away if they fuck up in one small way or say one thing that I don't totally feel certain about. Maybe I want to put in the effort to ask them about it, start a dialogue, or even, like, tell them, hey, that wasn't okay, don't do that again with me. And I think, like you were just saying there, like, if I'm noticing I don't feel comfortable saying that to them, and not just because it's early and we don't know each other well, but because I genuinely, like, don't feel like it would be received well, that is enough of a red flag for me usually that it's just, like, not worth continuing. But what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think this is a really tricky thing for all of those reasons. And also just, I don't know, it can feel like you've missed your vetting opportunity after the first date. That was your chance. You've bought in. You agreed to this now. And that, for me, that's one of the reasons I struggle a lot more at this point with being like, actually, I don't, you know, I don't think I'm down. I needed, it took a little longer. Not sure, no. But I think in practice, honestly, the conversation is largely similar to what we were talking about earlier. I think the big obstacle here is reminding yourself that you're able to change your mind. And slash, I know at least for me, that you're able to quote unquote be wrong. I thought I liked this person and now I don't. Oh no. But accepting that, like, vetting is an ongoing process and you're, like, you're able to be like, ah, you know what, we, these three dates were fun, you are a triple serving friend, have a nice life.
Yeah, I also think, like, early on in dating, I find it actually easier to bring up issues because there hasn't yet been this, like, established sense of, like, I'm going to be chill with everything. So, you know, I might say, like, I might text someone after a date and be like, hey, you made this comment that I felt like was maybe kind of sexist. What's up with that? And even just how they respond to that is going to give me a lot of information. Because if they're trying to defend that comment or explaining why it wasn't actually sexist, I'm going to be like, I don't know about this. But if they're like, oh my God, I totally see what you're saying. You're so right. I'm really sorry. I got to work on that. You know, like that kind of thing. That can give you a lot of good information.
What I like there too is that you talked about texting like after the date. Because I know for me as well, it can be one of those things where you're three dates in, you think you've vetted this person, right? You're all cozy and comfy with them now, and they say a thing, and you're like, I don't, how do I even address that? Oh God, it's been 10 minutes. I guess it's gone now. Yeah. And so I think it is important to remember that you can message them after and be like, just thinking about this thing that happened. I felt kind of weird about it. Can we touch base? And looking at that as an opportunity to say, to like practice this conversation on something that maybe is kind of trivial at this point. Because theoretically, if you keep doing this, there will certainly come a time when you have to sit down and say, hey, can we talk about that thing? It's going to be much less trivial. Just practice having not even difficult but serious conversations without them feeling once a year monumental special occasion kind of thing. No, we just talk about this shit. We just have this kind of relationship where a weird thing happens and we talk about it within like 12 hours like adults. It's wild.
Yeah, if you set that pattern,
start that shit early,
setting yourself up for success. One more listener question. It's a gender question, so it's for you. This is from...
The only one here with a gender.
This is from a trans person who says, how slash when do I disclose to straight cis men that I'm not a woman even though I have tits?
So this one is up there on my list of, I have, you know, a couple facts about me that ain't gonna change if I'm not compatible with these people. Like, if they don't agree with those things, well, fuck, I guess we're not compatible, right? And it's that I'm poly, that I'm kinky, that I'm trans, and obviously that I'm queer. So that's all shit that I don't wait to disclose. I have the privilege of being out anywhere and everywhere that I go, so it's not like I have to stay closeted if I'm, you know, in a small town and can only share this information with certain people who I'm particularly close with. That's a whole other conversation, and I would say that is a matter of trust and your own comfort with those, that person. But whenever you are able to, and whenever possible, I say that shit loud and early and often. I don't sit down and say, hey, we need to talk about these titties and the fact that I'm trans. I sit down, I make a stupid joke like that, right? You know, can't wait to get this weight off my chest, if that's the thing that you're doing. I say some silly trans thing, be like, ugh, trans life, am I right? You know, in the middle of my first date, and or just casually mention, you know, oh yeah, I was talking to them about being non-binary, and I was telling them about my experience this way, and they told me they experienced this. And just drop it like it's not news, and see how it goes, because honestly, it shouldn't be news. You shouldn't have to disclose it like it's cancer. It's just another fact about you in the many wheel of facts about you that they're going to learn over the course of that first date. And I think if you treat it that way, they're more likely to. And you're going to learn a whole lot about them, because, like, why wait 3 dates to find out they're going to be a shithead about it? It's a waste of both of your time.
Yeah, I do worry that, like, with straight cis men in particular, that even if you do reference gender in kind of an oblique way, they might actually totally miss it and not understand that that's what you're saying. And that's a tricky thing. Does that ever happen to you? Like, do you ever deal with that?
Yeah, I don't know that that has happened, but I would say just, I don't know, double down. You know what I mean? If you mention the one and it goes over their head, like, find a more obvious opportunity, right? And if they miss it several times, again, maybe just not so compatible.
Yeah, right? Maybe if they need several times.
Yeah, if they need that much remedial trans education. I can't think of many men that are worth that. To be fair, I can't think of many straight cis women that are worth that to me either. That's a lot of work, and I've been trans for a long time, and I'm tired of 101. But again, that's me, and those are my red flags and my standards for that. Your mileage may vary.
Yep. All right. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dildorks. This has been very interesting. I feel like I am equipped with new tools for the next time I have to vet someone.
Yes, the next time you're in a big public play space, because, you know, that's going to be nice and soon, meeting all those strange kinksters.
Yeah, it's just minutes away, surely. I've been Kate Sloan. I have a sex blog at girlyjuice.net. I also have a newsletter called Submissives, which is found at katesloan.substack.com. At time of recording, I had just earlier today written a newsletter about how painting my nails makes me feel a lot of ways about gender and about societal expectations. So you can read that. That one's free for everyone. And the subscription newsletter is $5 a month or $50 for the year. Where is your stuff?
I'm Bex. You can find me at BexTalkSex.com and at BexTalkSex on Twitter and Instagram. I'm also naked on the internet under Billy Lore. That's at Billy Lore on Twitter and justfor.fans/BillyLore, where you can see me doing all kinds of sexy and kinky things for your pleasure and mine. Together, we're the Dildorks. You can find us at thedildorks.com or at thedildorks on Twitter and Instagram. You can also go to patreon.com/thedildorks to throw money at us, help us keep doing what we're doing, and help pay for my new tattoo that I just booked. And I guess, like, my apartment and other grown-up important things.
But, I guess.
I just booked a tattoo appointment.
Yay! Exciting. We have some new hypotheticals going up soon that I seem to recall are very funny, although I don't really remember what was said because we were pretty high.
That's so okay. I can confirm. I was also pretty high when editing them, but I laughed a bunch, so.
That's all you need to know, really.
Yeah.
Thanks to Protodome. He did our theme song. Thank you to Amy. She did our logo. And thank you to you for listening. Until next time, folks, get out there and live your sexy, dorky life. Bye.
Bye.
There are people who could be doing stuff that you consider unsafe within your particular boundaries, but for them are okay. Do that again because I got very scratchy. In rope bondage, you know, I actually don't know enough about rope bondage to actually make this example work. I didn't make one veterinarian joke. It wouldn't have made sense, but it came into my mind many times.